This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
No! It can camouflage!
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Now watch closely, everyone. I'm going to show you how to kill a god.
Fire!
Welcome everybody to Cinematic Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are finishing off our two-parter on Studio Ghibli films to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Spirited Away, and looking at Prince...
Listeners, for those of you at home, Sam is in a rage, furiously stomping around his room and throwing things. It is a true sight to behold, a real display of troll power.
It's just that I spent like the last 2 weeks getting the pronunciation of Mononoke right, and then I fuck up princess.
I just pictured you every morning practicing in the mirror, like, Princess Mononoke, Princess Mononoke.
It's like a memento style. He's got it written on his arm, like,
post-it notes everywhere.
Do not trust monocle.
Today we are looking at Princess Mononoke. We will go over some news first. We'll tell you a bit about the movie as always, our reviews, and then get stuck into the science, including today two-tailed species, particularly foxes, gigantism, deforestation, and heavy metal poisoning. Now, as always, the show will be broke up into segments. We'll have time codes below so you can skip ahead to the bits you're looking for if there's a specific aspect of ecology or physiology you're more interested in. Before we get stuck in, though, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm a freshwater / invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in central Norway. With me today, as always, is Adam Hasek of the University of Arkansas. Fuck's sake.
That's where Skeletor went to university.
Yeah. A parasite / disease ecologist at the University of Arkansas, soon to be transitioning to the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. And alongside Adam is the Baroness, Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. And as every week, we're joined by Dave, our vet and movie physiologist. On news, what I thought was fascinating was that this week, two separate articles came out looking at the cost of invasive species. Now, we talk about invasive species a lot on this podcast, partly because I am an invasive species ecologist. But, I mean, they're one of the biggest threats to native biodiversity the world over. But we often focus on this sort of stuff and leave out the fact that they are incredibly damaging economically as well. So two articles came out this week. One focused on the UK, where they were talking about, you know, species such as the grey squirrel, Japanese knotweed, and the European rabbit, which they reckon have cost the UK economy at least $5 billion since the 1970s.
Wow.
Now, $5 billion since the 1970s sounds like a lot. As an invasive species ecologist, I saw that figure and I was like, there's no way it's that small. So I don't know where the numbers are coming from. And I can tell you at the same time that a similar article came out in Australia on The Conversation. For people who don't know, The Conversation is a really interesting biology news site. That publishes articles specifically written by scientists associated with educational institutes. And they say that in Australia, invasive species cost our economy about $25 billion a year. Now, $25 billion Australian dollars is the equivalent of about £10 in the UK, but it's still a lot of money for our government. And I am exaggerating there, of course.
That's a couple of rounds of fish and chips.
I got fish and chips because mum's working late. I know the owner and he calls me mate.
They reckon that in the last 60 years alone, invasive species have cost the Australian economy at least $390 billion.
Oh, crap.
That's like almost a third of the budget the US military gets every year. Almost.
Almost.
I was going to say, yeah. Moving on, do we have any positive news this week?
I mean, the main one I was going to say is Canada has now pulled ahead. We are at 59.2% of the population given its second doses.
Damn it.
We are number one.
Damn it.
Okay, cool. So, Libby, you want to sum up this movie for us?
Princess Mononoke was released in 1997, I believe. It is a story about a young village prince who tries to protect his village from a boar attack. he gets infected with this curse from this boar who turns out to be a god, an infected god. So he goes off to search for a cure for his curse, as well as figure out why the god was cursed in the first place. So he kind of stumbles into this war between this other town called Iron Town and a forest princess called Princess Monocle. And she's got
a Princess Monocle.
We do apologize.
she's a badass, and he ends up helping her, or she ends up helping him, figure out how to fix what's going on with not only his curse, but the destruction of the forest as well.
So what did we like about this movie?
I think for me, this movie, like any Ghibli movie, is going to have that really nice feeling of like a kind of a feel-good setting. Animation's really cool. I always enjoy movies that have this bridge between magical aspects and fairies and demons type deals, especially if they're like out in the woods and then like a human settlement, because obviously the Middle Ages would be a really shit place to live, but I always enjoy the fantasy aspect of living in some kind of medieval village, like in The Witcher, and then you go out in the woods and there's fucking monsters. It's cool.
Yeah. I loved the gray, the black and white of the characters, and I'd like to get Libby's thoughts on this going through sort of at the end. I still can't figure out if the lead female character is a villain or not. The mistress, who runs Iron Town?
Eboshi.
And like I finished a rewatch last night, and every time I watch this, it shifts between like, is she just a normal human? Is she villainous? Is she actually kind of a good guy in terms of like the representation that takes place? And I think that they frame the struggle in a really interesting way.
I enjoyed the fact that these characters, like Dave said, there was an element of complexity to them. And I'm not sure if this would change if I'd seen more Studio Ghibli films, but I enjoyed not knowing how things were going to turn out. Like, I've watched a lot of kind of pleasant kids films this year, although another thing I liked about this, a lot of fucking decapitations and limb loss. This is definitely not a kids film in some ways. A
lot of blood.
But I've watched a lot of really nice kids films this year, stuff that I enjoyed to a point, like Luca, The Last Dragon, stuff that you knew how it was going to turn out about 5 minutes in. And I enjoyed that watching this film, I didn't really have an idea of what was going to happen here. And to somewhat echo what Dave said, I enjoyed that
Ashitaka.
I enjoyed that Ashitaka was very much sympathetic with both sides. Yeah. Like, he could see that there were, you know, that there were humans on both sides of the struggle with real needs, to a point.
I think for me, just having a forest princess that rides around and has a companion of wolves was just like little Libby's life goals. So check.
For those of you that don't know, the Baroness in her spare time does just that. We don't have a large resident wolf population, but Libby found them, and you best believe she hangs out with them every day.
Oh. I'm trying to imagine Libby whipping her spear at various like wooden forts that still exist in the U.S. and then trying to like scrabble up the walls, and they're like, fuck, she's back. This is a reenactment center, young lady.
They're called Walmarts here, and I do that every day.
God damn, wolves are back!
So on the opposite side, what did we not like about this movie?
Nothing really stands out to me as something I don't like. It's just kind of a meh movie for me. I enjoyed it, but there was nothing that stood out as being incredibly good or incredibly bad. So for me, that's kind of a negative.
Okay.
There are some aspects of this movie I feel that don't hold up with times. Like the kimono's constantly falling open throughout the film. I was like, I really didn't feel like I needed that rewatching this last night. But I can remember as a teenage boy thinking that that was pretty cool.
Thank you for being honest.
I like with last week's movie, I found this somewhat disjointed a lot of the time. Like sometimes it'd just forget complete aspects of the plot. And of course you can have, you know, shifting plot lines that intertwine, but I felt like the last chunk of this movie, when all of a sudden for 20 minutes, apropos of nothing, they have to get the forest god's head back, was just like, what is going on? Again, it felt like 6 20-minute episodes of a TV show or something like that.
Yeah.
The characters were complex, but sometimes to the point of, I don't understand your motivations here. Eboshi was, for an example, like, he talked about the fact that she uses lepers, and former sex workers. And sometimes I'm like, okay, yeah, this seems right, but other times I'm just like, are you just exploiting disadvantaged people for cheap labor? And there was this moment that I could not stand when Ashitaka meets Sun for the first time. She's like, why did you do that? And he's like, because you're so beautiful. And she's just like, oh, God. He's flawed me with his charm. And I just fuck off with that shit.
And I feel like any child raised by wolves is not going to know what charm is, much less language.
Or know what beauty is in a social, construct. Yeah.
Are you strong? Cool. Are you not strong? We kill you.
Yeah. I think for me, I felt similarly to you, Sam, is kind of the opposite of Spirited Away. You know, last week with Spirited Away, I said the more that I watched the movie, the more I liked it, and I kind of disliked it originally. Princess Mononoke is the opposite for me. So I originally really liked this movie when I first watched it. And the more I watched it, which I've seen it about 5 or 6 times, the less and less I like it.
Hmm.
I think part of that reason being it does feel really disjointed. Like even just reading like plot summary stuff, it just starts going all over the place. And then also I think the feminist aspect of this movie is confusing because I think it's been touted for a long time as a feminist movie. In a lot of ways it is. I'm not trying to cut credit where it's due because especially for 1997, it ain't bad, but there's things in it where you're like, what? And I don't know about that.
You complete me. And I just had...
Shut up. Just shut up. You had me at hello.
Trivia. Do we have any interesting trivia?
I know that it took him 16 years to design this movie, which I thought was pretty fascinating.
To design? As in, like, do the drawings and the animation? Or?
Yep.
Holy shit. Okay.
It was Japan's highest grossing movie ever until Titanic came out a few months later.
Really? Wow.
Yep. Huh.
Okay.
And it was in that year, it was the biggest movie Japan had.
Yeah, so when this was released in America, this is my favorite bit of trivia, it was dubbed into English, and the script was written by Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
And
I thought that was really cool, yeah. Gillian Anderson is in the English version as well,
yeah.
Apparently.
Billy Bob Thornton, Minnie Driver.
Minnie Driver,
yeah, wow. There's a ton of people in the English.
Holy crap, yeah, Claire Danes, John DiMaggio, god damn.
Bender.
If I had known this was the voice cast, I may have actually watched a dubbed version.
Yeah.
I think the only other trivia I have is that the Ashitaka's, quote, sister at the beginning of the movie is not his sister. Miyazaki said that's his bride-to-be, and the term little sister is an affectionate term.
Oh.
What do you mean I'm joking? My whole family tree is just a circle.
Okay, before we get stuck into the science today, if you have any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam or me on Twitter. I'm at BigDrFishboy. Adam is at HarsikAdam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to read Libby's work, visit shortstorysoup.substack.com, and you can sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. If you want to get in touch with us directly, you can join our Discord server. Libby, Adam, how does one do that?
Well, you have to download the Discord app, either on your computer or on your phone, your computer, laptop, phone, desktop, what have you. And simply search Cinematica Animalia for the server. It's a public server. You can join, and there's ways to chat with us, suggest monsters, reviews, talk about science, show off your pets. Please show off your pets. We love them.
If you want to hear about some of the other science that Adam and I and a huge team of international writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And as always, if you like the podcast, tell a friend, pass it on, let people know.
Please.
Give us an in-app rating. It really helps. Okay, so... I wanted to start off today by talking about one of the first things that struck me about this film, which is, and Dave, correct me if I'm getting this wrong, bicordal animals? Polycordal animals?
Yep.
Yeah? So basically animals with more than one tail. Because the lead wolf, I can't remember, is it just the lead wolf, the she-wolf, that has two tails?
I think so.
This does happen, and has popped up a lot in Chinese and Japanese folklore, particularly with foxes. So there's a mythical being called, and I apologize if I'm getting the pronunciation wrong, Kitsune.
Mm-hmm.
These are creatures of superior intelligence, which are actually shapeshifters. They just normally take the form of a fox. They can shapeshift into humans as well. And they have up to 9 tails, which I believe is where the Pokemon comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anyone's wondering, yeah. These are foxes, though. not wolves. So some cats can actually be polychordal, if I'm not mistaken, Dave. Mm-hmm. But this is kind of more of a split in the tails, right?
Yep.
Rather than two... and this is, I think, a theme that occurs across most of them. I don't think there's any species, even when there is a genetic mutation and they have two tails, where they can operate both independently. It's mainly because, I mean, that would take an enormous amount of brain power, right? Dave, I'm assuming that, like with fingers, it takes a bit of brain motor function to operate a tail?
Depending on the organism. But yeah, they end up having their own area that's associated with the primary motor cortex for tail control.
Yeah.
But... I mean, it depends. Dog tails don't tend to have a super amount of neurological function, which is why they don't do anything all that interesting except for sort of bounce back and forth. It's definitely much more complicated in animals like cats or monkeys where you're actually coordinating the muscle and the motion, which is one of the reasons like dogs seem to like break their tail or bang their tail and they don't really seem all that interested. They're not doing a lot of like precise movement with it. And there isn't always a huge amount of like conscious or sympathetic control that's associated with it.
Okay. So theoretically, it wouldn't be too much of a drag apart from some extra energy put into growth for a wolf to have two tails.
No, it wouldn't serve the function that we think tails serve. It wouldn't make any sense to have two because the main reason we think that dogs and other canids evolved the tail because they're not using it for balance like other species are, potentially, but it's not really. Yeah. We think it's mainly just they've got anal glands, and when they're expressing the anal glands, they're wanting to waft that smell out to give more information to the rest of the pack or to potential mates. That's why dogs have anal glands. And we think that's the primary reason why they've got those big tails that just seem to brush back and forth, is just to spread that out to say, like, hey, here is information.
Yep. It's also pretty good from a social signaling point of view, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for like there is a little bit of like, yes, I'm sad. Yes, I'm excited. Yes, these things are going well.
Okay.
Are you sure it's not like Tails from Sonic the Hedgehog to flip around in a helicopter and get around?
I've seen that documentary. They can't fly.
I would love to see Moro in this just start like her tail going and she's like, guess what, bitches? Now I drop bombs from the sky.
I'm a wolfcopter.
But she's so big, it's just her butt that's in the air. She just kind of runs on her front legs.
Yeah. Now, polychordally, I mean, it's not what birds have, but we can often think of things like swifts or swallows, which have tails that are kind of split into two. That does actually help with balance and flight. And fish often will have a mutation that gives them two caudal fins. And as humans are wont to do, we will see a two-tailed fish and we'll think, that's awesome, I'm going to breed for that. So there are, you know, pet species of fish all over the world who have been bred for their genetic mutation, which is two-tailed. Yeah.
There are, there's a species of bird, the state right next to us, Oklahoma, their state bird is the scissor-tail swallow, which is one of those tails that has a big split, but it is longer, the length of the tail, those tail feathers is longer than the actual body itself. They look really ungainly when they fly. And then odonates, the dragonflies, damselflies that I work with, the males have what are called cerci. There's these two like finger-like appendages at the end of their abdomen that they use to grab onto the back of the female's like head or like her quote shoulders, insects on their shoulders, which they then hold onto, and the female then bring her abdomen up to the male's penis to mate. But those are some really sophisticated and highly adapted to within a species mechanisms of like a lock and a key formation, so a male of one species can't easily grab a female of another.
And then one of the coolest examples that I found when I was looking for this is that some lizards, species within the Lepidosaur family, which is essentially lizards, snakes, and a few other different types of reptile, will break off the tail when threatened or when they've been caught. Now, a really cool thing that I didn't know before this, I assumed that that was not a conscious function, that it just happened when the tail was tugged on in a certain manner, which actually isn't the case. Their tails are set up with a series of breakage planes along the vertebrae, which they can consciously release if something is tugging on their tail. So it's not like just something that automatically happens that they have no control over.
Mm-hmm.
They can consciously release their tail. Now, when a break has happened improperly along one of these breakage planes, sometimes splits can form. Whether that's one tail suddenly diverging into two or a main tail growing and small tails growing off it. I say tails because it can happen where that a species that this has happened to on one or multiple occasions can actually grow back like 5 or 6 different tails.
Cool. Wow.
Yeah. Looks horrifying, and I don't think it would help very much. But obviously, all these mechanisms that I've talked about and that Adam's talked about and that Dave's talked about, they don't work on a fucking wolf. Like, you do not need to escape from predators. I mean, I know there's some huge, horrifying animals in this world, but you do not need this as a wolf.
No.
But I think what we've got here is simply a genetic mutation that clearly hasn't been passed on because the wolf cubs don't have one.
Yep.
If you're going with the legend of the kitsune, maybe when the cubs reach 10 years, they will grow another tail. But I don't think that's what's happened here. I just think it's a genetic mutation that has occurred once and is not going to occur again.
From my understanding of that mythology, the more tails the creature has, the older, wiser, more powerful it is.
Yeah.
So she only has 2, so it's like 1 more than your basic wolf. So she's okay. Like an elevated wolf, but she's not necessarily like a super powerful 9-tailed being.
Jesus, he's not a f***ing god.
You don't know what I am. You don't know what I can do.
The point that I just kind of wanted to jump in, because aside from obviously the double-tailed system that we have in place, these wolves, as are the boar, are huge, right? There's multiple...
Enormous.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. There's multiple analogies made to the fact that, you know, they are much bigger and that they actually are getting smaller over time. Now, gigantism, the idea that we just get big organisms, does occur in nature and occurs in humans. Gigantism in humans is really interesting. It's basically just a condition characterized by the excessive growth or height, significantly above average, and almost always caused by overproduction of something called growth hormone, which basically it does exactly what it sounds like. It's one of those rare cases in biology where something is named properly and some asshole hasn't stuck their name on it, where they're like, I call this the Perrin hormone. And you're like, God damn it.
You are 2 inches shorter than me, motherfucker. You do not get to make eye jokes.
So the excess growth hormone is almost always triggered by some type of abnormality, something called an adenoma, which is technically a type of tumor that forms on the pituitary gland. And as a result, this gland that's present in the brain that sets your growth rate ends up overproducing, and you get these animals that are really large. Now, gigantism in humans during overproduction, it's not super dangerous. I mean, it is. As they get older, they'll run into problems associated with circulation. They get strains on heart. They can end up with a lot of like pain and discomfort. And the best example that we have that we cite for most of the time, for examples of gigantism, is Andre the Giant. In terms of just a very large human that was able to still live a decently full life before, unfortunately, he passed secondary to the strain that was placed on his body. The condition was apparently incredibly painful for him near the end, which is why he drank so aggressively into his later life to try and deal with the discomfort, because really they didn't have good pain medication to try and provide him, which is why we hear stories of like the Princess Bride, where he actually couldn't lift up the princess in many of the scenes. Which is where they had to like help to support her or support him in ways that they could use movie magic to make it work. Now, in the more dangerous condition that can occur with gigantism is what happens with young organisms before the growth plates fuse. And when they're in that situation, bones are still able to grow as excessive growth hormone kicks in. So the underlying structures are able to build. There aren't great treatments that are available for gigantism, and we kind of just usually let these organisms live out their life knowing that their life expectancy is going to be reduced. Now, the much more concerning case is acromegaly. So acromegaly is a disorder that results from excess growth hormone production after the growth plates are closed. Other associated tissues start to grow without the bones being involved. So you get enlargement of the forehead, the jaw, the nose. Hands start to grow. It usually is associated with incredible joint pain, headaches, problems with vision. They're more likely to develop diabetes, sleep apnea, high blood pressure. This is a condition in human medicine that we work aggressively to treat because of the possible complications as they get older. I think that we could just explain what's taking place with these wolves as either one, just genetically, they're bigger organisms. We see larger creatures like elephants. We see larger creatures like rhinos, and they're fine. I don't think we're necessarily in a situation where we've got these mutated wolves that are experiencing overproduction of growth hormones. We probably just have this bigger species.
I was just going to say, with the boars, though, that could present serious problems, because boars, their legs are set up whereby they essentially, like most artiodactyls, carry their whole body on their toes, right? And they're able to do that because most boars are smallish. But these things are getting big to the point where their legs potentially couldn't support their bodies anymore.
They would probably have a change in their body plan. I don't know what would happen if I scaled up a wolf like this. You'd probably have to make modifications to the bone design and make modifications, as we've talked about before, to the feet. Toes don't tend to work all that well as you get bigger, which is why elephants have them kind of pushed in.
And their joints.
Yeah. Well as your ability to jump. I mean, I don't know if I see Moro or the other species being able to jump down those cliffs at top speed without doing serious damage to their joints and to their bones.
Yeah.
Speaking of joint damage and such, another example I wanted to bring up, everyone always cites Andre the Giant as an example of gigantism, but one that always stuck with me ever since I read about him in one of the Guinness World Book of Records is a man named Robert Waddilow, who was born in Alton, Illinois, which is right next to Pierre Marquette, actually, Libby, a little place for my family holidays sometimes. He was born in 1918, and he died at a final height of 8 feet and 11.1 inches, or 272 centimeters tall.
Wow.
He is the tallest verified human to have ever lived. He died at the age of 22 after an infection from one of his leg braces, which had cut him, eventually traveled up his body and killed him. He didn't really have any feeling in his legs or his feet, as Dave was kind of talking about with those people who grow that much. Your nerves can't really keep up with it all, and it's just really, really difficult to live.
Yeah. No, he, I mean, that wasn't, can't have been an easy life. Like, we talk about growing pains, like, that's a lot of growing.
Yeah.
He was apparently still growing at the time of his death.
Going that big, it must have been exhausting.
I slept for 3 days straight. You have no idea.
Okay, so on this note, there have been a lot of kind of analogues to the species we see in this movie in the past. We'll start off with the most obvious one, which is the direwolf. So people have probably heard of direwolves. They were quite popular before Game of Thrones came along, but I feel like everybody knows what a direwolf is now that Game of Thrones has popularized them.
And since died a horrible death.
Yes. Yeah. Horrifying. Heads cut off, stuck on human bodies. Did any of them... One of them survived, right?
I don't think any of them survived.
Fuck. No, Arya survived.
Oh yeah, she the Nymeria.
Nymeria.
She was just a wild wolf. She doesn't really get touched on in the movies, but in the books, she becomes a menace for everyone in the kingdom because she leads this enormous super pack of wolves in the Riverlands where all the wars are going on. So there's just these huge super packs led by this, as they call her, a demonic she-wolf that's just eating the fuck out of everyone they can get their hands on.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, she's a badass.
Cool.
But yeah, direwolves were only actually thought to be about 20% bigger than common wolves today. Interestingly enough, so we knew a lot about direwolves beforehand because they're one of the animals that were found, there was quite a lot of found in the La Brea tar pits. The La Brea tar pits are the only reason that anybody should ever go to LA. And there are this, incredible set of tar pits with massive amounts of, I think there were mastodon skeletons, and there are a lot of direwolves found in there as well. Now, due to their kind of superficial resemblance to wolves, we always assumed they were related. However, there was new genetic analysis that was published earlier this year, and it was, I think, 5 different specimens from different museums and universities across the world that contributed genetic material. They were able to build a profile. They got about 25% of the genome sequenced, and they found out that this is pretty much a completely new lineage.
Oh, wow.
They shouldn't belong in the same genus as wolves, coyotes, foxes, anything like that. They think they were very different in terms of their evolutionary ancestry.
That's really cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was, like I said, it was a big study that came out just earlier this year. But then the other species you have. Now, just briefly, I want to say in the English dub, Ashitaka's steed is constantly referred to as a red elk. That thing is not an elk. That looks much more like a species of antelope. There was a writer who has described it as being much more similar to I don't know how to pronounce this animal's name correctly, but a lechwe. L-E-C-H-W-E. Yeah, there are a number of different species it looks superficially similar to. Potentially a black buck. Or another species of large antelope, it looks much more like. Regardless, elks have antlers. That thing definitely has horns.
Interesting.
Yeah. But the red elk, I don't find that interesting. What is interesting is the giant elks, or the analogues of what I'm assuming is supposed to be an Irish elk,
yeah,
which the forest spirit is seen leading around.
Right.
Now, Irish elks, despite being called Irish elks, were widespread across Asia and Europe.
Enormous animals. Look them up. They're really cool.
Absolutely huge. And as they were a lot larger, their antlers were often a lot larger. Now, they would never have reached the weird kind of tendril-like complexity that the forest spirit in this movie has. But size-wise, these are the ones that are closest to, probably closest to what we see in the film. These things were massive. Old ones would have had really complex antlers. That's, in general, how it works with most of the elk species. Oh, cool. Moose, caribou, that sort of thing. Every year, they grow back. They shed velvet. Antlers are actually an organ, fun fact, according to Andre Ofstad, Dr. Andre Ofstad, who's been on the podcast before. They're the fastest growing organ on the planet.
Cool.
Because they grow back every year. They will shed velvet and get really bloody. And they'll come back bigger almost every year.
For the size thing you're talking about, the creature's not reaching that size. Boar get quite large, especially here in the southeastern United States. I've had the pleasure / terror of seeing one in the field during my field work a couple of years ago. It was a massive sow. She must have been over 2 meters long, probably about 1.5 meters tall at the shoulder. Very, very large, 100-kilo animal with her piglets. So I was trying to stay well away so she didn't try to kill me.
Yeah. But the coolest one, which, you know, Adam's just touched on, is the Entelodont, I feel. The Entelodont is a family of pig-like omnivores, I should say, that existed, I believe, across, again, most of Europe and Asia? That existed across North America about 20 to 40 million years ago. And these things were massive. They would probably be up to, I think, about shoulder height on ours, the largest species that they've found.
Mm-hmm.
And they think they were superficially related to pigs. There are some theories and some evidence that suggest they're actually more closely related to hippos and whales, which, given what whales were like 30 million years ago, is no less terrifying at all. And then related to them again... somewhat less pig-like, but has been said by some scientists to be the largest land mammal that's a carnivore. It's called Andrewsarchus, bearing a very superficial resemblance to the boars we see here. They do look more like giant wild boars than either of these two species are thought to look like. But, you know, I think it's cool that, you know, in this world, potentially you've got massive entelodonts roaming around and still fucking up the countryside.
Wild boar are terrifying.
Very terrifying. Especially when... Oh, my segue skills are on point today. Especially when they've been poisoned by some heavy metal. Right, Dave?
Yeah. So...
Now, that is a segue you can't buy for love or money.
With Cinematica Animalia, my favorite thing every week that we try to do is take something that takes place in a movie and try to add some scientific background to how it would potentially occur within the real world. And the part that always stands out to me every time I watch the movie is the transformation into the demons. So the primary exposure at the beginning being the big boar god that's been hit with the iron bullet that takes on the appearance with sort of the dark black tendrils coming off its body. That when contacting with Ashitaka transmits over the curse that becomes referred to throughout the rest of the film and also takes place later with Akato. Yeah, Akato. So the transmission that takes place to turn him into a demon as well. Now, the easiest explanation for this is heavy metal toxicity, right? We know that there can be a couple of different metals that can transmit over and create unwanted clinical signs. They don't occur that quickly. Now, just to touch on it, because I'm sure that if anyone does sort of a brief Google search, they'll be like, well, this could be iron toxicity. And yeah, iron poisoning does occur. And I didn't realize this, but for the longest time, iron toxicity was actually the number one leading cause of death from medication overdose associated with children under the age of 6 in the United States.
Huh.
And basically what this was kids were getting into their multivitamin packs where the iron concentrations were really high. kind of during the last century, and then they were eating them because a lot of these tasted really good, or they were chewable, or they were friendly. And then in these situations, iron toxicity would occur. So the body can't metabolize super high doses of iron. Excess iron starts to irritate the lining of the gastrointestinal tract, and from there, serious complications take place. So initial signs are nausea and abdominal pain. Vomiting and blood start to occur, and then it leads to extensive diarrhea and dehydration, eventually going into dizziness, low blood pressure, so a weak pulse, headache, fever, shortness of breath, fluid in the lungs, and then eventually they take on jaundice and seizures as the liver starts to fail. Now, that's not what we're seeing in the film. The boar that we're seeing running around in the infected organisms, their biggest trait that seems to be associated is they're just not neurologically appropriate. They're thrashing, they're attacking, and even Moro says at the end when she's looking at Okoto, she's like, you can't even talk anymore, can you? The easiest explanation for why we're getting neurological shift is going to be lead poisoning. So the brain is the most sensitive when associated with lead. Early symptoms of just a mild amount of lead poisoning in adults tend to be nonspecific, so they get sort of depression, loss of appetite, abdominal pain, nausea, constipation. But if they start to get really large doses of it, and potentially either over a long period of time, or if they get a really large acute or short-term dosage, they'll start to develop neurological problems as the metal moves into the central nervous system. Insomnia, delirium, tremors, hallucinations, and convulsions. All of these things would explain kind of what we're seeing in the boar gods, where they're sort of fighting and attacking and turning on everything. And even Okoto's realization where he looks at those boar that are clearly not boar at the end, the soldiers that are trying to bring him to the pond, and he's like, my men have come back, and it's like, no, they're very much wearing your friend's dead skin. So when encephalopathy starts to develop, this material gets into the brain and all of those things start to occur. I think that the lead would kind of fit best with everything that's taking on. Is basically they're in a situation where the mining that they're getting, the iron that is being produced, is in a situation where it's lead contaminated. And I just don't think they're at a technological level where they fully understood that. And there's probably a lot more lead in these bullets. Now, it would require a really high dosage to bring this on. But these are pretty large boar. If you shot a series of bullets into them, they somehow survived, and those bullets started to secrete into the bloodstream, you could start to see neurological effects. Now, the neurological effects don't fully explain everything that's going on, because there's two other things that need to occur with these. One, it has to be transmissible, because when the prince touches the boar, he gets the transmission of the curse. And two, it has to create a specific pattern associated with the skin. So I was actually having a lot of trouble putting this mechanism together last night until I ended up rewatching the movie, because the first thing that I was trying to think about was, one, there have been some really interesting papers coming out that have been looking at, are there easier ways to test for lead toxicity? With everything that's going on in Flint, Michigan, and with the concerns that large concentrations of lead are going to lead to severe deficits with the children exposed, regularly taking blood samples from these kids is really painful, and it's kind of an unnecessary strain. So there have been some research looking at, can we simply look at saliva concentrations? Because it turns out that lead is secreted in the saliva. And it's turned out it's a pretty unreliable mechanism. It doesn't correlate well with blood concentrations. But that's one mechanism. So if the affected boar demon basically had a large amount of lead that was secreted into the mouth and bit our prince, maybe he's transmitting lead into the skin. That's a possibility. The other possibility that is far darker is that secretly behind the scenes, they killed the boar god and ate it. If you consume large amounts of lead-affected meat, it will transmit the curse. If the prince had killed it and in some sort of ritual that was associated with his tribe was like, oh, I eat the heart, or other organs that would be the liver maybe that's really contaminated, or even more specifically the brain, and then was like, oh no, I got this curse. Who could have seen this come on? That's definitely a way that we could have had it spread. Now, the much easier mechanism, and it didn't come to me until I was watching this movie last night, was looking at who's making the bullets for Irontown. And the construction of the bullets and the construction of the weapon are the lepers. So just as a quick overview, leprosy is triggered by a mycobacterium. It's not super contagious. 95% of those who have interactions with those with leprosy will not actually find themselves affected. with the
really,
yeah. So very, very low pathogenicity associated with this type of mycobacterium. We've actually struggled for a really long time to try and figure out how leprosy is transmitted, because obviously you are 5 to 8 times likelier to get it if you come in contact with a human who has leprosy, but it doesn't seem to be direct contact with the flesh. And the newest papers that have been coming out have actually suggested that spread is thought to occur through either cough or contact with fluid from the nose of basically a person infected by leprosy. So if the lepers are manufacturing these bullets and they're in a situation where they're regularly wiping their noses or they're coughing over top of them and they're basically infecting these when shot into the boar god, if you look up the lesions that leprosy produces, it produces that sort of dark black, it looks like the tin or the flesh is getting eaten away that we see on the outside of the boar when the disease is crossed. And then if our prince basically comes in contact in either one, he's got a really shitty immune system, because people with immunosuppression, if they come in contact with a leper, are far more likely to get it. Or he comes in contact with either the cough or the nasal secretions in such a way that it hits an open wound. Like if in fact it isn't like the demon lurching off the body and grabbing his arm, if the boar bites him, creates an open wound, and he gets oral and nasal secretions into it, it could be producing that leprosy pattern we see across his skin. If that's the case, I wonder if that's why when he comes to Irontown and she's not taking the leader of Irontown isn't taking his curse all that seriously, it's because he's like, oh, I've been cursed. And she's like, yeah, it's leprosy. And he's like, it's such a terrible curse. And she's like, yeah, it's leprosy. I've got a bunch of those in the back. And then when she's like, do you want to stay? Right. When she's like, do you want to stay here and help me like fight the boar god? And he's like, no, I'm going to go off with my curse. And she's like, you mean leprosy? And she's like, I'm trying to get a cure for that. And he's like, hopefully I'll find a cure. And she's like, is he fucking listening to me? Or is the lead toxicity wrecking his brain?
It's interesting though, because obviously people couldn't have known in the Middle Ages that leprosy wasn't as transmissible as, you know, everyone had made it out to be. I guess it must have just been a case of the risk was low, but the potential danger was so high, because nobody wants to be a fucking leper.
You melt. It's horrible. You melt. It's a terrible disease.
Yeah, but that stigma has kind of stayed in. You know, everybody thinks don't go anywhere near a leper, you'll catch it fucking immediately.
Right. Yeah. And in their defense, 5% is still 5%.
Yeah.
As much as I like to think of myself in a situation where I'm like, oh, I'd be brave. 5% is 5%.
Yeah. For a disease where, as Adam said, you melt. Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, I completely missed this, the heavy metal toxicity when we were prepping for this and associating that with these demons. Because in my mind, it was always like some kind of fungal infection. I think it works on the heavy metal toxicity because lead poisoning does do some terrible things to the brain, as Dave was saying. I don't know how. I think this is just a U.S. thing. I don't know if it's also North America in general with Mexico and Canada as well. But in the 20th century, a lot of the water was supplied with lead pipes, and there was a lot of lead in the environment. It was in the gas. It was everywhere. And so a lot of people in this country were exposed to pretty low levels of lead poisoning. And that is one of the theories for why there were so many serial killers in the 70s and the 80s, because it affects your functioning so much. It makes you aggressive. Wow. It makes you really bad. And obviously, the forensic methods, the detective work, it wasn't the same then as it is now. Like, you can't just track someone's cell phone and figure out where they were. And there's part of that is why it's harder for there to be a serial killer nowadays than there used to be, and there still are, unfortunately. But there seemed to be so many at that time, because the serial killers who were active in the 70s and the 80s were kids, and they would have grown up with this high amount of lead poisoning in their lives. So that's part of it. But for the fungal aspect of it, I think one thing that could work for this is you see these disgusting growths coming out of the boar that look a lot like what an ant or another insect as opposed to cordyceps fungus looks like whenever these fungal bodies starts fruiting and sprouting out of their bodies, which does affect neural functioning. It makes it really easy to get horizontal transmission. So for Akitoshi to be infected just by simply touching it by getting spores on himself, which then start growing at his arm. And those then also affect neural functioning, but it's not going to be in the same way as this hyper-aggressive, very, demented behavior. It's more of just, they always call them, fungal zombies, because they're just very robotic in their movements and what they do.
Well, I have a question, and not to throw another hitch in the giddy-up, as we say.
Do we say that?
But doesn't he gain super strength from this infection.
He does.
So how does that work?
The theory that I had sort of going forward is either the lead or another heavy metal that's present is fucking with probably his adrenal system as well as his neurological ability to feel pain. So he's probably going through what we've talked about before. Short bursts of adrenaline are going to put him in a position where he can do things. He won't be able to bend a Japanese sword, but I'm wondering if he's just in a situation where like he walks like through the sword and the captain of the guard is like, oh dear God, stop grabbing my sword. And he's like, I bent it. And it's like, no, your hand. And he's like, I bent it.
Hand's got leprosy. You're not going to want to use that sword for a while.
Right. Or he gets shot and he's like, I'm so invincible. And they're like, you're bleeding. And he's like, no, I'm not. And he just keeps walking. And then he finally gets to the gate.
Ain't got time to right? bleed.
He finally gets to the gate and he's trying to push through it. And they're like, we'll just open the gate. And he's like, I'm super strong.
Yeah.
And they're like, just open the fucking gate. Get him out. We don't know what's wrong with him. Get him the fuck out of the building.
He can go and live with that wolf woman. He'll probably infect her and take care of the whole problem for us.
Exactly. Right, exactly. Just get him out.
The Black Knight always triumphs! Have at you! Come on, then.
Okay, the last thing I wanted to touch on is the concept of deforestation, which is seen as this really horrible, you know, kind of tragic and dramatic thing in this movie, but it is happening all the time in almost every country around the world on a constant basis. And I do want to point out that we characterize deforestation as something awful that happens to like chimpanzees and panda bears in awful regions of the world where there's no English speakers. But that's absolute crap. Deforestation happens everywhere. Australia, for instance, has one of the highest rates of deforestation in the world. As a quasi European, I would also say that over here, the only reason Europeans feel so high and mighty about it is because they've destroyed most of Europe's natural forest generations and generations ago. And in North America, in North America, deforestation rates are also really high. We hear some really encouraging things about planting trees, tree planting projects all the time. It's nothing compared to the amount that we cut down every year. And we go on about this a lot, but a huge majority of that is down to cattle production.
Yeah.
And cattle maintenance. 60% of the biomass of mammals on the face of the planet is cattle. Another 36% is humans. 4% is wild mammals. If you want to help deforestation, because you absolutely should, because not only are trees a huge carbon sink worldwide, but natural and old growth forest is a massive source of biodiversity, of plenty of species of plants and animals that we haven't even discovered yet in some places. If you want to help, one of the best things you can do, you don't have to go vegetarian or vegan, although as Adam, Libby, and I can tell you, it's a lot easier than it sounds, but just eat less beef. If the whole world ate less beef, you know, cut down on meals, you know, 4 or 5 times a month, we'd be in a much better position.
Yep.
So that's kind of our plea for this week.
I think with regard to that as well, with the deforestation, it's also fragmentation is a huge issue, especially here in the U.S., yeah. where you're leaving, quote, habitat, but it's so far away from other suitable habitat that organisms are not able to move from one area to another. They're basically isolated on these little habitat islands. Which is where you get into the inbreeding we talked about earlier in the episode, like Alabama. And there's only so much genetic diversity left in that population. They eventually start going through an inbreeding depression where they more and more of these recessive and bad traits come out because there's not enough diversity to kind of override all of that. So, and I will never forget the conversation with my lab mate, Anita, shout out to her. She's a researcher that I worked with in Sweden. And she was looking at Google Maps for some reason and called me over to ask questions about, like, what the fuck is going on with the U.S.? Because it was just miles and square kilometers and enormous swaths of land were all just cornfield. And she was disgusted and horrified by it. Like, all these areas are so much bigger than her entire country. And it's just one monoculture. So one single group of one plant species, which, for diversity's sake, really fucks everything up. One of my colleagues here in Arkansas... his entire backyard, he has just kind of let go wild. He put a big garden up. He doesn't mow the grass, anything like that. And he gets a really cool amount of different native organisms. Insects, birds, reptiles, mammals come to visit, come to hang out. And then he just showed pictures of his side of the fence and then his neighbor right next door. And it was just really sad and a jarring comparison between this weird obsession we have with cutting your grass really short and having this ugly barren patch and this really big wild patch full of life.
Yeah.
So I live in what I guess is, it's not really a duplex, but it's the same sort of concept. Two families living in one enormous kind of house. We were upstairs, they're downstairs, and so we have to share the garden. And so we've kind of split it in half, whereby half of it is our half, which is growing wild, and the other half they take care of. And they like to mow it, which I understand it, but it's really unfortunate. However, we have this one wild patch that we just do not touch at all. It's not huge, it's fairly small, but you know, what else can you do? You go into that, and in a 1 meter quadrant, you find 7 or 8 different species of plant and 2 or 3 different species of insect. You go any 1 meter quadrant outside of that, it falls apart. It's just grass everywhere. And often people say, well, you know, it's still a green patch, right? If you've got a monoculture or even just a mowed lawn, it might look like a green patch, but it's an ecological desert. There is nothing for species there whatsoever. And across the world, pollinators are having a really bloody hard time. That's not just bees. That's insects like flies, mosquitoes.
Wasps.
Wasps. Yeah. And bats. They're really struggling. And lawns are... I know everyone thinks, you know, a desperate housewife's lawn is fantastic, but they're really terrible for biodiversity.
That and fucking golf courses.
I think there's alternatives to that, too. Like, if you like that look of, you know, obviously... Not everyone wants like waist high grass. And I think that there's, correct me if I'm wrong, options as far as using more sustainable lawns. So like I know one of my friends has like a clover lawn, so they don't have to mow at all, which is awesome. But it's also very like a lot more ecologically friendly than Bermuda grass is.
And the fun thing is that a lot of people think that, you know, you have to do all this research and find out which plants are native and which plants aren't. But a lot better than doing all that kind of research is just letting it grow wild.
Yeah. I think my favorite point touching on that, and it's the last thing I'll say about it, is I can't remember who shared it on Twitter, but it was this 18th century French lord, someone looking like Louis XVI, standing in a mowed lawn, said, "Are you an 18th century French lord? No? Then why does your lawn look like this?"
Yeah.
Because they are the ones who started this trend, and they should be ashamed.
Yeah, done a lot of bad things for insect biodiversity and subsequently bird biodiversity across Europe.
Off with their heads, I say.
Off with his head!
I can't watch.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of segues nicely into just talking about environmentalism and films in general. Obviously, there are a lot of environmental themes in this film. It would be hard to ignore them.
Yeah.
And I think I mostly wanted to touch on how... sort of two parts to this. One, I think it is really, really important to have environmental themes in films. Obviously, films themselves, not to get too meta, but films themselves are not very ecologically friendly or the production process. However, it is really, really good to reach the large scale population that we have on this planet. There's no medium quite like it. You know, you talk about paintings, you talk about music. And I think film is the combination of all those things, right? You have the visual, you have the auditory, and it just marries so well into this perfect art form that can really, really be super impactful for a lot of people. I know there's several films that have changed my viewpoints on, you know, things from personal emotional aspects to me becoming vegan to, you know, being a lot more environmentally friendly in my own right. So I think that it's really important. However,
caveat.
However, I do think that just from a plot point, from my writer narrative pet peeve background, I do not like films that beat you over the head with a message. So I think it's a fine line. It's a fine line to walk between conveying something that's very important and trying to put a message into a context in which a lot of people can understand, right? Because that's the other difficult part. And then beating you over the head with said message. And I think that, to me, Princess Mononoke, I I think it falls a little under the head beady category, just personally. There's just a lot of things that seem a little too on the nose. But not that that's a bad thing too much. It just, I think, could have been a little bit more subtle in the sense of getting this point across to audiences. But I don't know. What are y'all's thoughts about that? How do you feel like Princess Mononoke handled environmentalism as a theme?
I think for me, it was fine. It didn't seem too over the heady. I think it was more, from my point of view, it was more a bit more accurate and a realistic portrayal of what actually happens when humans really start fucking shit up like this. I think the only other one I can think of is maybe Ferngully, but then you have Tim Curry getting to play Hexus, the sludge monster, so that's the best thing to come out of that. So we should make more, you know, rainforest sludge monsters so they can all be Tim Curry. Pocahontas is obviously partly another one, but it's not in the same way. That's more colonizers and invaders.
Avatar is another big one.
Avatar, there we go.
Yeah. But Avatar is Ferngully.
Yeah.
Like, it's the same movie, yeah.
Yeah.
But Libby, to throw it back to you, what side, so something like Avatar, what side of the line do you think that falls on?
I think Avatar, in of itself, because it is so fantastical, I don't think it becomes too browbeaty. I think with Princess Mononoke, because so much of it is based in, I know it is fantastical, but to me it's a lot more realistic than an alien world. You know, you have these medieval humans, you have creatures that are essentially regular creatures, like a boar and a wolf, just with small fantastical changes. Whereas Avatar, you have just this massive scale of biodiversity that humans have never seen before and, you know, connecting to it in a way that we don't, you know, have never done before.
Unobtainium.
Yeah. So I think to me, because it was a little bit more fantastical, it didn't become so obvious as to what the theme was.
Okay.
Even though it wasn't.
Yeah.
Now, if I can throw a story question as well, Libby, because I sort of hinted at this at the beginning. Rewatching this last night, like I think that Ashitaka does a good job of, as Sam pointed out, I like that he's sort of trying to play on both sides of the fence and be like, hey, like, they both have interesting points. The watch through that I had last night, I was fucking hating Lady Eboshi, who previously I had felt like we got to the end where like the wolf's going after her arm, and I was just like, fucking let her die. She just killed the forest spirit. But do we think that maybe Lady Eboshi is just seeing like the creature as another obstacle? Like, so I didn't know if all sides were equal here, and I guess I wanted a story point on whether or not we felt that there was like a nice sort of, yeah, both sides have equal points here in this fight.
I think Miyazaki does a good job with her character because her character is all about the misunderstanding, right? I think that she is not a villain, but nor do I think that her actions are justified. I think that she makes these choices because she feels like she has to, but it's because she doesn't understand what the impact of her choices are doing. And I think that's, to me, her character represents humans, you know, more than any other character in the movie. So, you know, our decisions to do things in our daily life, we tend to look at that on a small scale. And much like, you know, Sam and Adam harp on all the time, so many things are interconnected. And when you make a choice to use a product or do something a certain way, that can have a massive impact that you're not thinking about later down the road. And I think her character is the personification of that, whereas she is rightly justified in doing what she thinks needs to be done. However, the misunderstanding comes from her part of not fully comprehending the impact that those decisions.
But I'm just a soul whose intentions are
so, do we feel bad for the, and I really kind of have to use quotation fingers here, monsters in this film?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%.
Oh, so much so.
Just animals living their lives who get fucked up by humans.
Yeah.
And just also, killing the forest spirit at the end doesn't just, like, kill the forest spirit and they get the head. The death of the forest spirit destroys the forest. Like, it starts bleeding through everything, and you see the trees going and the little spirits falling from the trees that are dying too. And you're like, you just fucked the entire thing.
It's what happens to forests concentrated down into one scene.
Yep. So speaking of a metaphor beating over the head.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all connected. You take that one part and the whole thing falls apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Would we recommend this movie?
100%.
I would. It's worth a watch, I think, Sam.
Somebody else go. I'm still making up my mind.
Livy?
I think I would. It's an interesting journey, and again, with all Studio Ghibli films, the soundtrack is so good. So I think visually it's really pretty, and it's definitely worth a watch.
I love a good film that doesn't end the way that I thought it was going to end, where it kind of ends and they're like, yeah, things are going to continue to get fucked. And you're like, no, like, I came here to escape. Like, things have to get better, right? The spirit's going to be okay. And they're like, no, sorry. Like, they did damage that can't be repaired. And I was like, no, where's the alternate cut?
Thinking about it now, I would recommend this movie if it was maybe half an hour, 45 minutes shorter. As it is, 2 hours, 20 minutes. I didn't enjoy this one very much. I enjoyed it more than Spirited Away, I think. Having said that, at the same time, Spirited Away is just completely bonkers. So, out of the two movies, despite the fact that I enjoyed this one a little more than Spirited Away, I would probably recommend Spirited Away more.
Speaking of things we hope we enjoy more, we finished our epic Hayao Miyazaki Studio Ghibli saga.
Ghibli.
Next week, we'll be moving on to James Gunn, The Suicide Squad. At the very worst, I don't think it can be any worse than the original Suicide Squad from 2016. So, looking forward
giant
to that.
Giant Starfish, though. Yeah.
Giant Starfish, Taika Waititi. We've got, he was the doctor.
Peter Capaldi.
Peter Capaldi's making an appearance, which I always love.
Mm-hmm. Shark Boy from Shark Boy vs. Lava Girls, all grown up.
He's all grown up, and now he's played by Sylvester Stallone, so I'm here for it. That's going to be amazing. Yeah, that's what we do next week. And as we say at the end of every episode, remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
In a time when gods walk the earth, an epic battle rages between the encroaching civilization of man and the gods of the forest.
When the forest has been cleared and the wolves wiped out, this place will be the richest land in the world.
Now, the fate of the world rests on the courage of one fearless princess.
I'm not afraid to die, and I would do anything to get the humans out of here.
And one brave warrior.
You fight like a demon, boy. Like something possessed.
What exactly are you here for?
To see with eyes unclouded by hate.
Princess Mononoke.